Well, water is a hot button issue in agricultural communities. And with the drought state of emergency in effect, KPCW's Jessica Lowell checked in with one North Summit County community.
The last time the city of Colville issued a water restriction was around 40 years ago. And despite the drought order, this year the city most likely won't see any issues, according to Colville Mayor Trevor Johnson.
On the culinary side, we are in great shape. We have more capacity to be able to store, and we're not concerned about the culinary system. The secondary system could play into that a little bit.
He says the secondary water supply in the city needs some work. Colville has been trying to get a grant to repair the city's pond, which can only be filled up 2/3 of the way due to leaks. He says the secondary water supply could affect the culinary supply.
If we can't pull enough secondary water out of Chalk Creek to fill our pond to keep, you know, people's lawns watered, and then people start using the culinary water, that might be where it could potentially impact it. But even then, I think we're still in a pretty good spot. So.
Johnson says the city's water prices for residents can run higher than other areas because both culinary and secondary water are on the bill. He also says the city recently updated its water infrastructure with a new sewer plant and water storage tank. These new amenities will now need to be paid off through grants and bonds, which has been a driver in the water bill costs in the city. And while Colville is still in the process of finalizing contracts for a building to treat the water for the shallow wells, Johnson says this project is the lowest on the city's priorities. They likely won't have to tap into the supply for 20 years. He feels the city shouldn't be any more worried about water supply than anywhere else in the state.
When our source runs low, it's about the time that everybody's source runs low. And if that happens sooner rather than later, for example, you know, kind of what we're gearing up for this year, we're going to be in no better or no worse shape than anybody else in the state, I think, with our secondary water.
He does say that Colville, like the rest of Utah, has a responsibility to conserve water.
I think if we can be smart in watering our fields, watering our lawns, be responsible in how we do that. But that's an age-old effort. Goes back generations and generations, and water is always a touchy subject, especially among agricultural communities.
A recent government study found rainstorms have become more erratic in the West, leading to longer droughts. As the planet continues to warm due to climate change, the U.S. Southwest is expected to experience more droughts. As summer approaches and conditions become drier, Johnson says the city will educate residents on water conservation, and if needed, they will use supplemental options to source more secondary water. Jessica Lowell.
I'm Carolyn Murray. I'm in for Leslie Thatcher this morning. Our local news hour, the first guest we have on the line is Midway Mayor Celeste Johnson, and she is here to talk about last week's meeting, their council meeting. It looks like some events are coming up for Midway City this summer. Good morning, Celeste. Thanks for coming on.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, no worries. So let's start off. I was listening in, of course, to the meeting last week, the Midway City Council meeting, and there were some kind of interesting things. It looks like perhaps the city is returning to a bit of normalcy this summer. The approval of a couple of events, the farmers market, organizers asked council for some dispensation for the coming season. Do you want to talk about the farmers market and what people can expect with that coming up next summer or this coming summer?
Yeah, we're excited that they're going to be coming back. They did an excellent job last summer of social distancing, of requiring masks, and they were able to hold the farmers market very successfully. And so we're thrilled that they're coming back. It's a fun community event, but it's also a fun event for driving awareness. People who come to the farmers market tend to shop at our shops and eat in our restaurants. So it's a win-win all the way around.
Yeah, and will there have to be, again, the same kind of social distancing practices that went into place last year? The mask ordinance is dropped at this point, the mandate. So what will happen? Will it look back to normal, basically?
You know, we're going to kind of play that by ear, and we're letting the folks who run the market make that decision. We were told at the meeting that all of those vendors of the farmers market would be wearing masks. and that they would still probably put down some sort of reminders, you know, markers on the ground to remind folks about social distancing. You know, if our numbers continue to go down in our county and we do an excellent job of tracking where things come from, if, you know, if nothing's coming from the market from, in a negative sense, I would love to see some semblance of normalcy, but it's far more important that we continue to stay safe until we've got this pandemic under control.
Sure. And I imagine those ideas also apply to the Wasatch All Road event, which had come before the organizers came before the city council asking for a grant, which was provided $2,500 to help them organize this event. Talk a little bit about what this Wasatch All Road event will mean for Midway and the residents.
You know, this is a first for Midway, and so it, I suppose on some level it remains to be seen. The organizers of the event intend to include information about lodging opportunities in Midway, as well as the rest, as well as Heber. We intend to put some literature in the packet about Midway, the restaurants, etc. The event doesn't take place in Midway itself. So it's an event that is off-road and more on the east side of the valley. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, how it does trickle into Midway and what we end up seeing as a result of it. And it's part of a rising craze of a bike race, the skinnier road tire, not the big fat mountain bike tire, but it is on gravel. So it's evidently the latest thing in bicycle racing.
Yeah, they were interesting how many people they thought they'd have entries. 1,500. They said they had 500 signed up already. So
yes,
significant size bike race. And yeah, the gravel road racing is something that's definitely of interest in the biking industry. So let's move on to drier topics like Michael Henke's update with the legislature. Talk a little bit about House Bill 98. It allows a building permit applicant to engage an independent third-party building inspector to conduct inspections in certain circumstances. What does the city council, how did they respond to this?
Well, first of all, it was Michael Kohler that gave the report. He's our House of Representatives representative, and I know he takes in part of Summit County as well. But Mike, you know, briefly touched on the fact that there's markers, I suppose. If the city is unable to meet a certain timeline, then it would become a possibility. My building official has been keeping a close eye on this bill. Of course, we don't feel comfortable with it. We don't believe contractors should be able to hire their own inspectors. I mean, it smacks of all kinds of corruption opportunities. So we have in Midway, we are able to meet our timelines. We should never be impacted by this legislation. But it isn't something that my building officials are at all comfortable with. So we'll do everything we can to keep to the timelines we've been able to do.
Yeah. Okay. And then there was also a billboard bill that did not pass, but it does look like everyone thinks it's going to return next year. And this would affect Midway City's Main Street signage, wouldn't it?
Well, potentially. And that's what's weird about that particular bill. Once again, you've got a very strong outdoor sign lobby group that wants, if you have billboards, you have to be able to allow them to be electronic. That's one of them. And then I don't know that I know the particulars about the other one. There were actually two billboard signs that were trying to make it through. That's the one that concerns me the most. In Midway, we don't have billboards. All of our signs, nothing can be higher than 8 feet. We have a square foot code for our outdoor signs. It's one of the things that keeps our Main Street looking so charming. And the concern, of course, is that if the outdoor sign lobby can start to take control of what a municipality is willing to allow in their city, you know, then once again, the state has stripped the municipality of making decisions that's best for their locale. So, you know, if somehow that billboard sign would also apply to lower signs like what we have at Midway, which we don't allow to be backlit or electronic, then all of a sudden the signs that we have could become that. And that's something that we're very troubled by.
Yeah, so I guess something to watch, and I presume Mike Kohler will be watching that carefully through the special sessions, perhaps, as well as next year's legislative session. Okay, let's talk about ranked choice voting for 2021. That was shut down basically by the council, and I know I feel like this is something you really wanted to try and you wanted to pass. Why do you think council didn't want to allow for ranked choice voting in this case?
You know, the information they gave in their arguments were, one, they felt like it would become confusing, and two, that it was a problem looking for a solution looking for a problem. I disagreed with both of those because, first of all, it's become abundantly clear that voter reform is necessary, and I don't know that we're going to find the silver bullet unless we start attempting some different methods. And that's going to require change. And ultimately, I believe that that was the bottom line discomfort level. Ranked choice voting could be provide multiple benefits. One being you eliminate the need for the primary, so you save some expense there. But the other being that you are able to list your candidates one through however many candidates there are. And if your number one choice is not elected, there's a chance your number two would be. And so you feel like you are still, and in fact, you are a part of the process, even if your first choice is not elected. So I saw some benefits. My council did not. And unfortunately, I feel like it's too bad because Heber did pass it in their city. And so I felt like it would be the year to give it a try with both our municipalities doing it. But council did not see it that way.
Sure. Okay. Are you there still?
Yep, I am. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I've got you. Good. Okay, I thought I had lost you for a second there. So talk also then about the Lower River annexation. It's a 350-acre parcel, 18 property owners, a proposed development with a 100-room hotel, cottages, lots of commercial square footage, and it looks like affordable housing is part of this, and also some trail opportunities, a trail network, and even estate homes. So that was approved, that annexation. Can you let our listeners
actually
know?
No. It was only the motion was to move it to the next step. So it's far from approved. When there's an annexation, there are multiple steps involved in the process. What happens now is that our city recorder and our city attorney will look at the petition, and this is what the council voted on for them to go to the next step. So they will look at that petition. If it meets all of the requirements, the state's requirements for annexation, which I want to make abundantly clear, are less stringent than Midway City's requirements. So the state has several criteria. If it meets those criteria, then what happens is it's called the certified. So the petition is certified. That then opens up the timeline for any government organization that wishes to protest the annexation. So there's a 30-day window when the protesting parties can file their protests against the annexation. If there are protests, and we do anticipate that there will be, then a boundary commission is established, and basically it'll be taken out of the city's hands at that point as the boundary commission determines if this should be annexed or not.
Okay. And what's the timeline on that?
So right now, we have until the 20th to certify the petition, and then there's a 30-day protest window. And then after that period, there is the Boundary Commission will do their work, and that could take months and months. Well, they will hear from those who are protesting, and I understand that they will hear from those who want to develop as well and who want to annex it. So it's quite a process, and it's far from being approved.
Oh, okay. So what, as far as the expected protest. Do you anticipate that there will be some of that? How effective is that? I mean, will that really stop the annexation if enough people come out and are against it?
So it can't just be the neighbors, right? It can't just be the homes that are going to be forced into the annexation. So the developer's property is about 200 acres. But in order for that property to annex, and there's some state rules about this, but based on the size and the value, et cetera, any contiguous properties that are between the annexation and the current Midway city limits are by default then have to annex in. So you have those homes, and we have heard from many of those homeowners. They, however, cannot be part of the protest. The protest can only be done by a government entity. So we anticipate the Heber Valley Special Service District, which is the sewer service, will be protesting, possibly the county, possibly Heber City as well. And the biggest reason here is that this project bumps up against the sewer district's property. And the sewer district is very concerned about development encroaching. Because of the odor issue, there have been cases where even new development has won over a pre-existing sewer plant, and that would end up costing our community millions and millions and millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. So there are some very legitimate concerns.
Yeah, okay. Something to follow then. And then just really quickly, how did the vaccination efforts, the Johnson & Johnson vaccines that were available on Saturday go? Did you fill up all those slots? Did you get a lot of people vaccinated during that event?
I believe so. I actually won't get the report on that until tomorrow. But Wasatch County just hasn't had any problem with getting our slots filled. And people are very interested, obviously, in getting the vaccine. And the county has just done an amazing job of just making it the most seamless, easy process ever. It just takes a few minutes. It's a drive-through process, and I can't imagine that it didn't get completely filled up. When I heard about it the Tuesday before, slots were already filling, and they hadn't even gotten the word out yet. So I'm quite certain it was full.
Okay. And is there a plan to run that clinic again this weekend?
Yeah, I have not heard.
Okay.
I don't know.
Well, keep us posted, and we can, of course, get that word out as new information comes in. We can get it out. Yeah, on the public service announcements. Anything else, Les? Quickly, we've got kind of ran out of time here, but anything else you want to point out?
You know, I think we covered all the high spots for this time. So okay. Thank you so much for having us on. Take care.
Our next guest is Andrew Kaplan. He is a Park City School Board member. He is on the line to talk about financing. Good morning, Andrew. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks. We had a two-year master planning process, and from that exercise, we came out with three priorities that were defined by the very many stakeholders that were involved in the effort. This is just to give a little background, and now it's time to implement these basically top three priorities. And the first one, of course, is ninth grade, getting moved back into the high school. Ecker Hill would absorb the eighth grade and become a sixth through eighth grade middle school. And then the district would embark on a universal pre-K program at each of the four elementary schools. Two of those elementary schools would also have wraparound services. And then also tucked in there is another priority expressed by the community, and that is to using green building practices as much as possible through this process of basically expanding six of our schools. Priorities here are probably looking like a cost of somewhere around $100 million to $130 million, maybe $140 million in capital projects. And but you had mentioned in the last school board meeting that there are some different kinds of financing options that are being considered and that the school board is looking into. And with that description, have I missed anything as far as where the school board is going in terms of the master planning and the needs of the district?
No, I think that's a pretty good summary. We've been working on this really, if we take a step back, probably starting in 2014 or 15, around the last time that the community considered a bond, which failed in 2015. So the process has been going on for quite some time. I think we were very deliberate this time around and spent a lot of time working on the ed spec and what we wanted as a community, what we wanted education to look like in our buildings. I think the COVID pandemic, helped solidify some of that when we learned that, technology is really, really important. And education is definitely not going to look the same as it has, in this community over the past 20, 30, 40 years or around the country. So I think it's fortunate timing that we're at the stage of the process now. We're actively looking at different financing options and how as a community it makes sense to pay for this.
Yeah. And of course, school boards in Utah typically use a voter bond for the large projects, similar to what our school district here in Park City is looking at. But why don't you talk a little bit about some of the options that you've been exploring and different ways of looking at the growth and the phasing and how to transition the schools in the ways that have been outlined by the master planning process?
Sure. So one of the big things that we're looking at is how do we make this project, which is, obviously it's really not one project. It's really multiple, six or seven projects when you look at kind of every elementary school. So all four elementary schools having an annex added. And then you're looking at both Ecker and the high school having expansions and then eventually the demolition of Treasure. So it's seven projects altogether, and it's going to be multi-year. And what we're looking at is how do we make that as least disruptive to the students over the next several years as possible. Now, fortunately, we have Treasure and, we can do the additions at the high school and at Ecker. While children are in school, it will be somewhat disruptive because of the noise. But what we're trying to figure out is how do we, it's a bit of a jigsaw puzzle, but how do we do all this without having kids in trailers for extended periods of time? And I think from what we understand from the architects and from our consultants, that is a possibility. In terms of the financing options that you asked about. Right now rates are still very low. They've been moving higher, but the price for or the coupon that we would have to pay to borrow money for 15 years on a general obligation bond, and the general obligation bond is what you described as kind of the most traditional form of financing, is about 1.65% for 15 years. So that's very low. It's very low because it's guaranteed by the state if it's issued in that way. It's kind of the lowest way that we can finance that. But right now, lease revenue bonds, which are bonds backed by the actual buildings, are only about 0.3% higher. 1.9%. And the possibility of bank loans are also in line with that, so somewhere around that 1.9%. And those are market rates. All three of those are viable options. They all have differences in terms of timing. The drawback, the advantage of the general obligation bond is that it's slightly cheaper. The drawback is, you can't start them until you have a vote and then you're actually able to issue them. So the earliest we'd be able to get financing would be the spring of 2022. The other bonds are a little bit more flexible in timing, and now obviously bank loans are also a little bit more flexible in timing. So makes it a little bit easier to start the projects earlier, which obviously would impact the completion time of the projects. In addition, you know, we're speaking to several, you know, bank partners and trying to figure out, okay, is there a possibility that we can get loans at that level or slightly better that could be comparable to what the general obligation bond interest would be. And that's an interesting possibility. You know, we've been approached by Zions Public Finance, and they've been very helpful in trying to help us unlock value from public land that we own. And so we're exploring some possibilities with them as well in terms of what kind of financing rates we could get. You know, and along those lines as well, we're also talking to them and some other local Utah-based foundations that have interest in helping support our community through social impact projects, which include, you know, early childhood education and, you know, wraparound services such as mental health and health services and things like that. And this is a, you know, this is a very generous state in terms of foundations and charity. And it seems like there is a lot of willingness to get involved, both from public foundations as well as some private family foundations that are located in our community. So we're exploring all of those as well. We're also looking at potentially partnering with an institution, possibly a developer, to help us build some housing for teachers on our property. And if we do that, that could also help create some income long term for us that would help offset some of our expenses. So, you know, if we take a look at what is the cost of this project, obviously the headline number is pretty big. You know, as you mentioned, somewhere 100 to 140 million, depending on which projects we move ahead with. You know, the cost, what does that mean per family, per household over the next 15 years in terms of taxes? And, you know, the cost is roughly $200 per $1 million of property value a year for a primary homeowner. So, you know, if you look at the average price of a home in our community and you figure it's around $1 million, give or take, then, you know, each family would be responsible for an additional $200 in taxes. And that's an estimate based on kind of average interest expense today and principal repayments. But that's kind of the ballpark. Now, the last thing I'd say is you mentioned our other priority, which is to make these buildings as green as possible. And what we've learned is that's a very expensive proposition. It's a shared interest we have with the community, but the cost of that is about $75 per square foot, and that adds up. That's, you know, that could be $30, $40 million on the total price tag. And so we're, you know, as a board, we're reviewing it and trying to figure out, okay, do we do all of the green improvements at the same time, or do we set our buildings up so that they're ready for solar and ready for all of these different improvements, and then look for federal grants and state grants to make our buildings a little bit more environmentally sound and try to reduce our cost on that through some grants and other tactics. So that's kind of where we are now, and happy to answer any questions you have.
Yeah. So I'm kind of interested in understanding if you're able to even talk about this, but the discussion about unlocking some of the publicly held land, the public school lands that that mm-hmm. our school district has. I know we had just purchased a parcel that is over by Highland Drive, and that's been sort of undefined whether that would be a school site or possibly an investment of, you know, teacher housing, something like that. But there's also, we haven't talked in a long time about the Bear Hollow site. That at one point was being discussed as an elementary or a middle school site or something along those lines. Are those properties in play on this discussion?
And yeah, well, Bear Hollow has some pretty strict zoning on it, which would only allows for a school facility. And the building, the actual building envelope is relatively small as well. So it would have to be a multi-level building, most likely, which kind of increased the construction expense, as you would imagine. So, you know, nothing's off the table, but I think that one, you know, continues to be regarded as land bank for, you know, future growth. We also have a piece of property in Silver Creek, same kind of situation. It doesn't really have utility hookups, things like that. And I think we're, you know, we're keeping that as is for now. The parcel that we bought over by Trailside, you know, I think we're happy land banking it if we need to. There's obviously quite a bit of expansion happening on that part of towards that end of the district in terms of housing and things like that. So I think that's a good strategic purchase for us and at a very good price. But we would also consider looking at that and potentially putting some employee housing on it, you know, depending on density and et cetera. And we would look to, you know, work with obviously the county to explore those options should they pencil out from a financial perspective. But I think we have a shared interest with the community that, you know, we want to be able to continue to attract and retain the best educators for our kids. And, you know, it's a high quality problem to have, but as housing continues to really, you know, continue to ramp up in terms of home values, it becomes harder and harder for people in the education profession to be able to afford to live in the community that they teach in. And, you know, if we want to think out another 10 years, 15 years, you know, where are we going to be with our educators? We're going to need to be pretty creative and create some opportunities for housing for them. So that's one of the things we're looking at. And that's something that some of the public finance folks at Zions have been helpful with in terms of just kicking around ideas. So we're going to continue to look at that as well.
Okay. And then so as far as the bond initiative, if that were to go on the ballot this fall, you would be looking at sometime in August that a decision would need to be made. Is that correct? Is that sort of the timeline? Mid-August?
Yeah, we would have to put a bond. We'd have to, you know, August is kind of the drop dead date for a bond. I would hope that we're not going to get to that, leave it that late. I think, you know, we have to figure out relatively quickly in the next couple months what our other options are if we're not going to do the entire thing on a bond. You know, there's possibilities that we still do a bond for one or two of the projects and then maybe try to finance the early childhood with a different way, right? Or in a different fashion. So maybe we get some foundation money, maybe we run a capital campaign and use some of our reserves for that. There's a lot of different angles for that project. But I think, you know, will we do some bond issuance? Absolutely. I'd be shocked if we didn't. But, you know, will it be the whole thing and will it be all in one shot? That's what we have to decide as a board. And that's what we're kind of leaving open. But I think, you know, look, it's an exciting time for the district. We have come out of the COVID pandemic in great shape as a district. I think the superintendent and her admin team have been complete all-stars and should be given some type of award, you know, this year for keeping our schools open all year. I mean, I think something like 1 in 10 schools across the country were open the entire school year, and they just did an outstanding job. And, you know, we had a ton of families moving here from other places because our schools are open. Yeah. And now it's kind of time to finally put the ribbon on this project that we've been working on for so long and figure out what the schools and the facilities will look like, you know, for the next 10 to 15 years. So we're fully focused on it. We're hard at work. We're trying to reduce the, you know, the tax increase as much as possible. And that's our goal, you know, to be able to provide these upgrades to our facilities without costing the taxpayers a ton of money. And that's why we're trying to be as creative as possible.
Sure, sure. Okay, well, you know what? We're out of time. We're going to have to leave it there. And we'll be, of course, covering and talking with school board members and possibly Todd Hauber, I believe, right after the school board meeting next week. So thanks for joining us and giving us this sort of mid-month update. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
Take care.
Speak soon.
Well, the Park City Education Foundation's Bright Futures program gives first-generation college-bound students the support and mentoring to attend post-secondary school and graduate. The kids who participate in Bright Futures are required to commit in 10th grade. It's not for everyone because the meetings, the family engagement, and the overall expectations are rigorous. The opportunity to attend college is one thing, but the Ed Foundation states that just 11% of first-generation college students graduate. The Bright Futures mentors help students choose the right school, manage financial aid applications, and meet deadlines. They get help with resume writing and interviewing, and as they progress through the high school years, they learn about the social and emotional skills needed to succeed in college. Park City High School senior Sikali Garcia said the program isn't just centered on the student because going to college takes a supportive family.
It's also like awesome because they involve our parents a lot. They take them to a college trip. They have meetings for themselves a couple times every other month. So they get them involved too, which is like awesome. So they like educate our parents as well. So it's just like a really like beautiful bond.
Garcia said she wants to study education and go to South Korea and teach English after college. She's applied to a study abroad internship program there this summer. She said the support received from Bright Futures mentors had changed her mentality and her family's view of what is possible.
It was this really long application that I was just really complicating wording and everything. And Nikki helped me with that and with the recommendation and everything. And right now I'm at the finalist stage and I'll find out this month if I go to South Korea. You can dream as far as you want to and they'll support you in anything. Those dreams of mine, like me going to China my junior year, I worked really hard for it. And it seemed like a really unrealistic dream to do all these things. But mentors there, they really push you and they're like, you can do it. You can do anything you set your mind to.
And Rodolfo Cornejo is in 10th grade and his first year with Bright Futures. He has many interests and hasn't decided his path in college yet.
And I'm hoping to expand my horizon and do important work. For example, during the summer, I am planning to internship at a few wildlife conservation centers here in Park City. So I'm kind of exploring a lot of options right now. And wildlife conservation is really something that would be interesting to me.
Cornejo enjoys the culinary arts and science and is taking chemistry this year. He said he is beginning to consider different college majors.
I have begun getting quite a few emails from colleges from Arizona, Utah, California, even from all the way in Montana recently, from Colorado and a bunch of colleges. And I am currently exploring those colleges, seeing like what majors there are, what programs there are.
Cornejo is an only child, and he will be the first to attend college in his family. Garcia has an older sister in college. If you want to learn more about the Bright Futures program, go to PCEF for Kids. And with that, we're going to transition into our final interview, which is Abby McNulty, the executive director for the Park City Education Foundation. Thank you for joining us, Abby. Are you there?
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Great. Thank
Great.
You. Yeah, so thanks for coming on this morning after the spring break. I know everybody was scattered throughout probably the desert Southwest for the most part.
Yeah.
Huh? So this is our monthly update. And let's just do a quick reminder. Park City Education Foundation, boy, what a year it's been. And I know it's been difficult for many nonprofits. How has the Ed Foundation fared? And what are the things that you maybe want to highlight as far as the accomplishments this year?
Sure. Well, it has been quite a year, and just echo what Andrew Kaplan said earlier with giant kudos to the Park City School District administrative team and teachers for doing an exceptional job this year, keeping our kids in school. school and engaged. The Education Foundation exists because Utah is the lowest funded education system in the country, and 96% of the tax dollars that are collected for education in our community leave the community to fund other school districts in the state. So Park City Education Foundation steps in to raise private dollars and infuses those resources into our schools. And every dollar to the Ed Foundation stays here in our community. We have been very grateful this year to have a strong year of support from our community, from our families, from our businesses, from family foundations to continue our work in funding programs. We fund about $1.5 million in programs every year into our 7 schools. And then in addition, with support from the Community Foundation and Summit County and Park City Municipal, we've also provided additional resources to address emergency needs that have been created because of the COVID pandemic and economic crisis. So emergency grants to families and to students, emergency grants to our Bright Future students who are in college, as well as to our education staff to help make ends meet in these really challenging times. And in addition, we created an express grant program to help teachers solve problems that were popping up in their classroom because of, you know, such a crazy year. It started last spring when schools went online, and we continued that throughout this whole year and made a commitment to teachers. If they seeked money from us, we turned the money around within 24 hours to help address the issue they were having in their classroom. Yeah. So I'm really proud of our team, our board members, our staff, of just really stepping in this year to find ways to provide meaningful support to teachers and students and families.
Yeah. Well, congratulations for managing through all this. But let me ask about, there's a showcase coming up that you wanted to talk about. Can you give us a little preview of that?
Yeah. So we have 2 showcases coming up. These are some of our final events of the year. We've actually moved everything this year to Zoom. I'll start with the Bright Futures one because I heard the nice story that you did. Thank you on the Bright Futures program, which is an initiative of the Ed Foundation. And as you mentioned, it supports first generation college students get to and through college. And because the Park City High School has such a really strong academic program and social emotional support program, partners a lot with Dream Big and Latinos in Action and Bright Futures, helps students once they graduate too, and to while they're in college and get to the finish line. As you mentioned in your story, only 11% of first generation college students actually make it to college graduation. And we are here to change the odds in our community. And so we want to celebrate. It's been a tough year for everyone. And on May 3rd is College Decision Day. And we will have our Bright Future students do a Zoom and share with the community where they're headed to college and what their dreams and plans are. We have 20 kids graduating as part of the Bright Futures 2021 class. And they'll announce where they're off to in the fall.
That's
May 3rd, 6 p.m.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And more information is on our website, and you can register for that Zoom. You have to register in advance, and it's pcef4kids.org.
Oh, that's great. Okay. And then there's
One of the things that Bright Futures does, too, is support students with scholarship while they're in college, those who have significant financial needs. So that's another piece of the program, not just the social-emotional mentoring, you know, advocating networking support, but also provide students with scholarships.
Okay. And we just have another minute here. You want to talk about the other event?
Yeah. So another big event we are hosting is on April 29th coming up. And this is a showcase of students who have graduated from Park City High School and have really charted their own paths and creatively in college and talking about their success, all attended highly selective and out-of-state schools. And it's a conversation about how the Park City High School does a fantastic job of preparing our students for college. About 40 to 50% of our Park City High School grads leave the state every year to go to colleges and universities, and are all participating in highly competitive majors. And as a parent, I know it's hard to imagine what our kids will be doing in 15 years as the workforce is changing so rapidly. And this is a great way to learn what kids from Park City are doing in the work force and really charting their own paths. It's incredibly exciting. So we have one student who, you know, created her own major at Harvard and is working in the food sustainability field. And we have another student who went to Stanford and is the author of a math YouTube channel with 3.5 million followers. We'll have about six students on the panel, and those are just two examples. And we encourage everyone to register April 29th, 7 p.m. It's also Zoom, and you can register at PCF's website, pcf4kids.org.
And I know Running with Ed, but we have like literally 10 seconds. Can you just give an update on Running with Ed?
May 22nd, now is the time to register your six-person team. And it's also on our website, or it has its own website, runningwithed.com.
Excellent. Well, thank you. That's Executive Director of the Park City Education Foundation, Abby McDulty. I appreciate that update this morning.
Thank you, Carolyn. Have a wonderful day.